This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Our show is called Main Street because our microphones make a Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. The real ones out there that we cross and say hello to our friends and neighbors are very important places in their communities. And, of course, oftentimes we'll shoo the fat about, you know, what's going on at home, talking about the family and this and that. And we're going to really dig into the family today. We've got several minutes to talk with a couple of experts about genealogy, researching family history, because the 42nd Annual Family History Workshop is coming up in Moorhead on Saturday, September 23rd. And Les Bakke joins me in studio. You've been with this workshop a long time, Les.
Long time, Doug, since the 80s.
And on the phone with us from the Twin Cities, Paula Stewart Warren. She is a certified genealogist, and she'll be one of the featured presenters this year. Thanks for joining us, Paula.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Les, what can workshop participants expect this year?
This year we have Paula, who's coming from the Twin Cities area, and she is very, very knowledgeable about genealogy, particularly in the upper Midwest. We haven't had anybody do that recently. A year ago we had someone who was with the Genealogy Roadshow, and we kind of move our emphasis around different aspects of genealogy in different parts of the country.
And how many people typically show up?
Last year we had 220.
Good turnout.
And our registration is running about the same. It might be slightly less, but
now, it's an all-day event. It's $49, get you lunch, too, and lots of resources. What are they going to leave with?
Yeah, they're going to leave with a booklet that has the information that our presenters are giving in their sessions. And they submitted it to us, and matter of fact, we're taking over for printing tomorrow.
All right. Paula, how did you get interested in family history?
My interest in family history kind of was an outgrowth of my love of history of the Twin Cities and of Minnesota. And I took a lot of community education classes. And one of the professors was talking about tracing the history of a business. And my great-grand-aunts owned Catholic Art and Bookshop in downtown St. Paul. And I started tracing about them and their history. And it really kind of got to me, you know, as anybody who does genealogy knows, it becomes quite addictive, and I just kind of branched off into that.
Well, I know Les was addicted to it as well,
yes,
right?
Yes, I have been since late 70s, I guess it was.
As I recall, you've tracked it way back.
Yeah, I was lucky when I was doing my research, because I got an email from a cousin over in Oslo, Norway, and he said, you know, I got some of our relatives way back when, and I'm willing to give you mine if you're willing to give me yours from the States. And we exchanged, and now it goes back over 1,000 years.
Wow. Paula, how do you become a certified genealogist?
It's basically through a testing process. You need to have education and experience and knowledge in the field of genealogy. And it involves doing a lot of reading, taking some courses and classes, and then just doing a lot of the research. You get to know a lot of different things. And the Board for Certification of Genealogists is based in Washington, D.C., and we go through a testing process. We submit examples of our work, and we get judged by 3 judges, and we don't know who they are. And then every 5 years, we have to renew. We have to show examples of continuing education, that we're keeping up to date in the field. So it's a good way to find a researcher if you need some help in some places, too.
Well, I was raised in a newspaper family, and, of course, the newspaper is one of those important resources, at least as long as there were newspapers. But what other important tools are there to track down your family history?
Oh, the federal census, the state censuses. State censuses for Minnesota and North Dakota are so helpful. As you mentioned, the newspapers, obituaries, wedding stories, probate records that we find in the courthouse, birth, death, and marriage records, and so many other things supply a lot of the details. There's no one record that tells you everything about an ancestor. You've got to learn about many different types of records.
When I was reading about your background, it says you focus on unusual resources. What are some examples of that?
Well, one of the things I like are the publications and indexes and abstracts that were done during the New Deal era, during the late 1930s, early 1940s, specifically the Historical Records Survey of the Works Projects Administration, part of Roosevelt's program to get the country back on its feet. And I also like to get people into manuscripts, because a lot of people forget. You know, people might leave an address book, a Christmas card list, a diary, a journal, maybe the records of a business. And they provide so much detail and background on a family.
Well, Les mentioned that there's going to be a sort of a focus on the Midwest family history from
this year.
That's specific to this area. And I know you were speaking about New Englanders in the Midwest. That is actually sort of my heritage. So tell me about what I'd learn if I showed up.
We have so many New Englanders that came into the Midwest, a lot of them early, a lot of them because the land was opening, especially once we had the Homestead Act in 1862, but many way before that, even before, for example, before North Dakota became a state. And into Minnesota, a lot of them came through Wisconsin to us. And there's so many indexes and records that people don't think about looking for their New England ancestors. And as I mentioned manuscripts a few minutes ago, a lot of these people, and it may not be your own ancestor, but maybe their neighbors, their fellow churchgoers, someone they associated with in an organization, may have left their records, and they may be in one of our wonderful historical societies, libraries, archives in our states up here.
Well, besides Paula, you've got lots of other presenters, Les.
We do.
Give us a sense of...
Okay. One of the more popular sessions of the last several years has been DNA presentations.
Yes.
lots of people are signing up to have their DNA done. And with that, from most of the groups, you can connect to blood relatives that are established or identified through the DNA.
And there are different kinds of DNA tests, aren't there?
There are. I am not the expert on that, but if you come to our workshop, we do have one.
All right. What else?
We have technology, as Doug knows, Paula, you may or may not. I'm an IT guy, and we have someone who's going to be there and showing how to convert old VHS tapes to digital tapes or to digital recordings from old family movies, whatever they are. He will also show how to do audio recordings to digital so you could use them, send them around, post them on the web, whatever.
Well, Paula, you're also going to be talking about controlling chaos, organizing your genealogical records, and that is an interesting challenge, it seems to me, because you just mentioned, you know, digitizing things. Well, how long will that program be good for and all that
exactly.
kind of stuff?
Yep.
So give us a short course in organizing or controlling the chaos of family records, Paula.
Biggest thing is to file things away immediately, whether it's in a computer file or a paper file you're putting in a file cabinet or a filing box. Get things labeled. Put them away. Put them in the proper place right away. I learned that. I can find things right away. I was doing some preparation for us talking today, and I looked up something, and I was able to put my hands on it. I can find the information on my relative, Ann Carlson, for whom the Ann Carlson Center in Jamestown is named for, and she's my first cousin twice removed. I have a lot of political family who were in Mandan, the Hanley family, so I can just go right to my files and find them because I learned many years ago, put things where they belong right away. Don't just put them in piles. Now, I do have to admit, I do have some piles of things that need to be filed.
Probably
no
always.
One's perfect.
I think we all do.
Yes.
The farmer in the Dell, and in many U.S. records, is the heading for another one of the workshop presentations you'll be doing, Paula. Tell our farm friends out there how to best search their records.
It is one of my favorite topics to do. And there's people think farmers, okay, they own land, so I just want to get the land deed. But there are so many other records that tell us more about our farmers, about the property, and about the crops or the animals that they had. One of the things that I like is that one of the topics I talk about are the bonanza farms, which in very northwestern Minnesota and into North Dakota, when I talk about them in other states, people look at me like I've got two heads. I'm going to be with an audience who knows about it. But farmers belong to organizations. Farmers left records. They left diaries or journals of what they planted, what the weather was like. Some people, you know, you can find out that they have estray notices where they put a notice in the newspaper, ends up in the court that says, I lost my cow Bessie, or someone found a cow Bessie, or this, you know, marks and brands. It's a never-ending list of how we can find more information about our farmer ancestors.
The 42nd Annual Family History Workshop is Saturday, September 23rd. It runs all day at Horizon Middle School in Moorhead. It's a $49 fee to take part in this day-long event, which, of course, has a lunch as well, and awards are given out every year.
And
right?
awards. This is something we started about 15 years ago. It wasn't part of the original thing. But we give an award, a certificate and recognition, not monetary award, but for people who have done family research and have produced something. And I say something because in the old days they used to produce books, but now it can be a web page, it can be a digital thing, it can be a video recording of their family. And we always have a number of people who submit their work.
A long time ago, Paula, my father gave his sons a detailed genealogy, at least as he knew, the family tree at that time. And my brother, a younger brother, has taken that up. And it's just coincidentally today, as we're having this conversation, he is in Detroit Lakes, where I was from originally, and handing over 400 years of history of the Hamilton, Blanding, Dunning, and Dix families, which came from New England to the Midwest a long time ago. It's just coincidental that it's happening today. But he's turning it over to the Becker County Historical Society, and that's another thing we might want to talk about, kind of paying it forward, if you will.
Exactly. You know, there's a lot of ways we pay it forward. If we do a family history, whether it be a 10-page booklet or a 700-page book, we need to make sure it gets into the places where our ancestors resided, into the historical societies, the libraries, the archives. And Les knows, so many of us that are involved in genealogy, we always pay it forward by volunteering. We you know, we're on boards of committees, and we keep our genealogical societies going. We keep events like this going. And I think the best thing I ever did in genealogy was agree to volunteer because, boy, did I meet a lot of nice friends.
Well, I actually worked with Les briefly with the Heritage Education Commission. He's been at it a long, long time. But so, Les, give us the description of this organization.
Okay, this is an organization that was originally formed when President Roland Dill was the president of Minnesota State University Moorhead back in 1976. And it's been in existence ever since. We call this our 42nd workshop. And if you do the math, you'll say, wait a minute, it should be 41. Well, we had 2 one-year. So this actually is the 42nd. It's a committee of about 13 to 15 people, all volunteers. The volunteers do all the work. We have no paid staff. About 3 years ago, we formed a partnership with Moorhead Community Education, which has really, really helped us a lot because they do the registration, manage that, and help put together registration materials and all that. And we hold it at one of our schools.
And those people who are listening who want to find out more, you can go to heritageed.com, and there's a link there for the workshop, and there's also other information about the organization and its goals. Both of you, how would you rate interest in family history research these days? I mean, are young people interested in this? Or?
Well, at least our workshop, I would say the average age is about our age, Doug. It's not in the 30s. Although every once in a while we do have some younger folks that do come in and have an interest. My sister-in-law brought her granddaughter last year and enjoyed it immensely.
Well, we probably enjoy looking in the rearview mirror a little more than other people do.
That's probably true.
At our age.
What do you see, Paula?
I just returned from the Federation of Genealogical Societies annual conference. This year it was held in Pittsburgh. And there were a lot more younger people in their 30s, a couple in their 20s. In fact, one woman I know brought her 16-year-old son. He wanted to learn more. But we are starting to get a few more. But though the average age of us is older, part of it is, you know, if someone's got a full-time job and three little kids at home, it's kind of hard for them to get us involved. But I think they're getting the bug more and more at a younger age, which I'm glad to see.
Well, I went up on your website, Paula. That's genealogybypaula.com, and you are busy.
Yes, I stay busy. This is my full-time job in the area of genealogy and history.
And I
love to travel.
You have an anecdote up there about actually being at the Minnesota State Fair, doing a live interview right there on the Midway.
Yeah. And it was kind of an interesting experience. Done some research on the Lennon sisters and on Tim Russell, who was a radio host for many years with WCCO Radio in the Twin Cities.
Very well-known person. He was one of the Garrison Keillor stalwarts on Prairie Home Companion.
Right.
Are you done with your family history, Paula, or is there still a stone to be turned?
Never. Never. I have my German family. I have a church that was bombed during World War II, so I don't have any microfilmed or digitized church records. Somehow I need to get to Germany. I've done a lot of on one of my Irish lines. My Swedish line is way back. That one's pretty well done. My Scottish line, I have some bugaboos in there. We're never done. We can keep going back and back and back, and then we find more. And then, because most of us, we don't call ourselves just genealogists anymore. We're family historians. We're including the current generation. So there's always marriages. There's always somebody going off to college. There's somebody having a new baby to add to our family tree. You're never done.
Well, it's always nice to know the name and the dates and all that kind of thing, but it seems to me that the richest part of the family history piece is the stories, the anecdotes, the other information that you can sometimes pin down.
That's what I want to know. I want to know who the people are, what they experienced in their lifetime.
And we have one session. Matter of fact, it's the first session in there about storytelling for our workshop this year. And you both are absolutely correct. Everybody else wants to read the story about Roger Hamilton, Doug's father, not just that he was born, he served, he did this, did that, but they want to know.
Yeah, it's what family members desperately want to know.
Absolutely.
Actually. And as we probably all can remember, we were probably told something when we were quite young, maybe in our teenage years even, and it just went in one ear and it went out the other, Paula. And it isn't until we get to a certain age, apparently, that we start, oh, what did he say? What was that story?
And we wish those people were still with us. We could say, what was that you told me? So we have to do the research to find it out. I can remember my maternal grandmother, when I asked her a question about something, and she said, well, our family used to live in Faribault, Minnesota. And I went, oh, I thought they were always in St. Paul. Things you learn that you just, you know, growing up, you don't think about.
Well, Les mentioned DNA, and of course that'll be one of the topics at the workshop on September 23rd. But are there other cutting-edge sort of research techniques in genealogy that we might not be aware of?
Research is research. The DNA helps because we've got so many companies and we're doing it. I'm helping a woman who found out that she's related to my son because of a soldier who was serving in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. We're trying to figure out who her father might be. Just the digitization of records, even though we still have tons of things in courthouses and archives and libraries that we still need to go there for. But so much is digitized. So that's what becomes cutting edge is we've got that resource online that we can go to and start our family history. We can do a lot of that. As Les had mentioned earlier, with the changes in how family histories are published, you know, many of them are online today or on a blog. They're digital. You know, somebody might even send it to somebody on a CD-ROM or put it in the cloud so people can look at it. It's so much is changing. It's changing day by day.
Well, it used to be you had to go to the newspaper and pull out one of those bound editions of each year. They'd put all the issues together so that they could kind of catalog them. And, of course, it's a lot easier now because newspapers have an online presence and they become more and more searchable and friendly.
Absolutely.
I would still rather touch the old newspaper.
Well, you and me.
Something about touching the original record book.
Well, there was something
if
about...
You have never done that.
There was something about walking into that newspaper shop and just smelling the ink and the newspaper and as well, too. So it's a...
Well, bet you love that.
It's an interesting sensory experience. Well, this is a real opportunity for people out there to get a day's worth of very concentrated information about how to research your family history. It's coming up, the 42nd Annual Family History Workshop, Saturday, September 23rd, from 8 in the morning until 4:15 in the afternoon at Horizon Middle School in Moorhead. More information at heritageed.com. Paula Stewart Warren, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to the workshop.
Les Bakke, always a pleasure to see you.
Fun to talk to you, Doug.
Coming up next on Main Street, a little more history. Tom Ezern shares a Plains Folk essay.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 64 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
100 years ago, there were some tensions around here. The U.S. had just declared war on Germany, and a lot of people had relatives there. Food production needed to ramp up, just as the prime workers were going off to the army. Native Americans wanted to volunteer, but they weren't legally U.S. citizens. Patriotism was running high. Flags, parades, and posters abounded. Hear about it on Dakota Datebook. At least once a week, we'll feature a World War I story, and you can see them on our website. Look for Prairie Public, The Great War.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. History is our theme today, and there's no better historian around here than distinguished professor of history Tom Ezern, who writes and voices the Plainsfolk essays for us. Today, his essay is titled Sharing Songs Across the Prairies.
New research convinces me now that Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim, the prairie parody of Will Hayes's popular 19th century ditty, Little Old Log Cabin in the Lane, deserves to be described as what I called it in my last essay, the anthem of the plains. By new research, I refer to the possibilities inherent in the digitization of newspapers from across the country and their compilation into the massive index Chronicling America, administered by the Library of Congress. These can be searched by term or by phrase, such as a song title. There are two things to remember about this body of evidence. First, it is incomplete. Only a few of the hundreds of the newspapers of the plains have been digitized. So whereas I have been able to locate dozens of versions of Little Old Sod Shanty in country town papers, I am certain there are hundreds more out there in newspapers not yet digitized. The second thing to remember is the systems by which 19th century newspapers were published. A key element in news distribution was the exchange system. Country newspapers mailed hundreds of copies to other papers, receiving exchanges in return. They lifted news and features from one another, sometimes with credit, sometimes not. So, we generally think of folk songs as circulating in what we call the oral tradition, that is, by word of mouth. Local newspaper interest, the need for copy, and the exchange system, however, rapidly moved folk songs in and out of the oral tradition, including many variations, errors, and ornamentations made by local singers. There are certain basic elements in most all prairie versions of Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim. It begins with a miserable, lonely bachelor living in rough circumstances, in a sod house, of course. Something like, I am looking rather seedy now while holding down my claim, and my victuals are not always served the best. And the mice play shyly round me as I lay me down to sleep in my little old sod shanty on the claim. There now, you hear how the rhyme scheme breaks down? Claim does not rhyme with best. I suspect that earlier versions of the song referred to a little old sod shanty in the West, thus perfecting the rhyme. Oral circulation, and for that matter, capricious typesetting, prompts variation, for good or ill. Typical stanzas go on to detail the sad circumstances of our poor homesteader. Monotonous food, vermin and varmints, dirt and mess, and most of all, lack of female companionship. The singer insists he is happy as a clam in this land of Uncle Sam, but he really wishes his sweetheart would come out and keep him company and maybe do some proper cooking. Undaunted, our singing homesteader looks ahead to when his future children are happily settled around him. Oh, then we'll be content for the years that we have spent in our little old sod shanty on the claim. Before me now are 18 previously unstudied versions of Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim I have gleaned from prairie papers using the Library of Congress Index Chronicling America. Next time, how our anthem of the plains multiplied and persisted on our western prairies.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, we'll find out about Gutes Essen, good eating in German-Russian country. It's Prairie Public's newest television documentary. And we'll have a Harvest Public Media report about grocery stores in rural communities. Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Despite objections from a handful of residents, the Grand Forks Council approved the use of a single voting site for the November special election to decide the fate of a 0.5% sales tax increase. Mary Weaver was a vocal critic of the decision to only use the Alaris Center during the June special election over Arbor Park. Weaver says her opinion hasn't changed.
In the words of Yogi Berra, it's deja vu all over again. It was 5 months ago we were talking about the same topic. I don't think the economic savings generated by one polling station is worth the distrust and long-term financial consequences that you're going to get from deliberately disenfranchising certain sections of the public.
Councilmember Danny Weigel says he's talked to a lot of people, and they say using a single site is not voter suppression.
Some were college students, some were adults, and I'd say about 80% of them looked at me and said, I don't know. I said, do you know where the Alaris Center is? Oh, yeah, I know where that is. Okay. So I think it for a special election with one thing on the ballot, that we choose a location that everybody seems to know where it is.
The $5 million generated by the tax would help fund road repairs and construction of the new water treatment plant. The election is set for November 7th. While Western North Dakota may have experienced the most severe impacts of this year's drought, the impacts can ripple across the state. Members of the Chamber of Fargo, Moorhead, and West Fargo had a chance to talk about drought and get a firsthand update on what the ramifications would be. Weston Dvorak is a rancher from Manning and was on one of the panelists for the Chamber's Eggs and Issues Breakfast. Dvorak says the dry weather left their operation with about 20% of their normal hay and forage. He says to help supplement the feed supply, they teamed up with other producers to find hay in the eastern part of the state.
We came out to in the Grand Forks County, Griggs County area. We shipped our swatters and our hay machinery out here, and we were making up all the hay out here and shipping the hay back.
Dvorak says it's not uncommon to hear of similar effects from cattle country. He says producers are continuing their fight to keep going.
About 50% of them are, well, I'll just sell down some cows and get through the drought that way. The other half of them are trying to find hay to feed all of their cows that they have or have to sell down some of them. So it's kind of a 50-50 mixed bag in my area, I guess, as far as people that will just sell down instead of having to pay for the high hay costs.
Dvorak says even if we have normal precipitation next spring, the effects of this year's drought will linger over the next 2 to 3 years. And a program that required Xcel Energy to offer compensation to customers in the Fargo area for power outages has been extended through the end of 2017. Under the plan, if a customer suffers 3 or more outages in a year, that customer was eligible for a bill credit of $50. Xcel had filed earlier to end the program, saying it had made progress in replacing some older underground power lines, but the Public Service Commission decided it will keep it in place a little longer. Here's Commissioner Brian Crotius.
At the end of the day, it's about providing more reliable service to the customers, and everybody knows what happens when you have a power outage. Nowadays, we live in such a highly electronic world. How many clocks do you have to reset, and everything's blinking in the house, and a long-term outage, of course, can cause more problems.
The PSC will look at the results at the end of the year, and it could vote to extend the program further. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Now, I had a boyfriend. He was going for a Cat Stevens look, but it doesn't really work when you have a retainer. He also had a tendency to refer to me as m'lady.
Join us next time for more True Stories Told Live. This week, camp, cars, cockroaches, and the Kremlin on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Bob Dambach. He is the director of television for Prairie Public, and he's in here to talk about a project that's about to be unveiled to all the TV viewers out there this Thursday, Bob.
That's correct. We have our brand new documentary in cooperation with the Tri-County Tourism Alliance. And it's called Gutes Essen, and it's good eating in German-Russian country, and that is exactly what it's all about. We have 10 of the nicest senior ladies that you've ever met cooking for us, wonderful people. And then we also the other side of it is we went and we visited a number of sausage makers and some bakeries as well.
There's a bit of competition out there in the sauerkraut triangle for sausage.
I would say that's true, yes.
Napoleon versus Wishick and all that kind of stuff. So how did this documentary get started?
Well, it really, if you remember back in the early 2000s, we did a program called Schmeckfest, and very popular German-Russian food. And Michael Miller, who we've worked on so many projects with, have talked for years about us updating it now in the high-definition world and maybe focusing just on one area of North Dakota, the area where he came from, the Stroudsburg Tri-County area out there. And it turned out that the Tri-County Tourism Alliance had done a cookbook called Everlasting Yeast a number of years ago.
Yes.
And they said, well, we'd like to partner with you on this. We'll find the cooks for us and work with you on the documentary. And that's what happened. And so a year after the initial talk, here we are.
Okay. Well, how is it put together? You got the 10 cooks, but how do you tell the story?
It's really interesting to me because when I think of this documentary, is it cooking and history and cooking?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a blend of both. We are in kitchens, and the ladies will take us through from the beginning to the end of the recipe, so you'll see how things are made. But while they're doing it, they do talk about their heritage, their history, where they started making the food. Items about the food, why the food is so important to the continuation of the German-Russian culture. And some of them have the most delightful accents you've ever heard in your life. And so it makes for an entertaining show. I would say the one thing that as you watch this show, especially with the 10 cooks, but even with a couple of our sausage makers, there is just a twinkle in the eye as they're telling their story and as they're cooking. And we did have a premiere of this, and there are parts when the audience just goes, ooh, and ah, looking at the food or anticipating what that food might taste like.
Well, I love the stuff, and I remember we talked to Sue Balcom about Everlasting Yeast, mm-hmm. that cookbook you referred to some time ago, and I think we've got a little snippet of her talking to some students at Napoleon School about the art of German-Russian cuisine.
Okay, come on up here. This is everybody's favorite part of cooking. Have you ever broken egg before?
We're demonstrating to the youngsters in the Napoleon school system how to bake Kuchen, potato bread, and make some sauerkraut. I always like to teach classes where we actually get people involved and into the bread dough and into the Kuchen dough and hands in the sauerkraut, because that's the best way to learn.
You guys are excellent.
The recipes that I use when I teach cooking classes are from my family. They're traditions that have been passed down from generation to generation. And these children have the same roots as I do. And so they easily related to all these wonderful recipes that I've collected over the past probably 5 years furiously from the generation above me, which will soon be gone.
The recipes that were handed down from my great-grandparents to my grandparents to my mother to myself were by something called osmosis. Do you know what osmosis is? It's kind of like if I stand next to her, we're exchanging molecules all the time. I spent all my Saturday mornings in the kitchen watching my mother bake. And that's kind of how I learned how to do what I do.
I think that somehow between a couple generations, our families have sort of lost a little bit of our German-Russian heritage, which was surrounding food. And these kids here are still fairly close to the land, but there are a lot of them that have moved away from here that absolutely have no idea about how important agriculture was and the gift of agriculture and food that the Germans from Russia brought to the state of North Dakota when they homesteaded.
3 pounds of cabbage and a teaspoon of salt. That's it. It's amazing, isn't it? It's just like science experiments all over the place. This is how we measure. Germans love food. Where I come from, somebody shows up on your doorstep, you just open another can of something and invite them in for dinner, because that's how we showed love. Nobody ever gave you lots of hugs. Nobody ever said, I love you all the time. But they sure as heck, if you were well fed, you knew you were loved. I spend time in the kitchen, and I invite them into the kitchen also, so that someday when they all have families of their own, my grandkids, that they'll be able to say, this is something that my grandmother used to make, and she used to make it with love.
Well, that's fun. That's Sue Balcom in the Gutes Essen, that's good eating in German-Russian country. It's our newest documentary from the television side of Prairie Public, and it celebrates that food culture of Germans from Russia during their, well, since their immigration to the state over 140 years ago.
Yeah, so. You can do the math. I can't. But
well, is there a cookbook? Yes, there is.
Yes, there is. You're holding it, Doug.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a companion cookbook, and Sue Balcom helped prepare this as well. Worked with her from the very beginning on this. It does feature every one of the 10 cooks that we have. Mm. Actually, 11 recipes were prepared by the cooks for this show, and all of them are in the book, as well as, oh, I don't know, 40, 50 more pages of recipes as well from some from the chefs that Sue used in the Everlasting East book as well. So there's quite a variety there, and there are a number of different spellings for the same items, because things are spelled differently, and there are a couple variations on items in there too, so you can try out the different recipes and see which one suits your taste the best. And as always, just like the documentaries, there's some history and culture as part of the book as well. It's a nice spiral-bound book, and it's the type of book you can actually take with you in the kitchen, open it up, and be able to cook from it.
It's like one of those cookbooks that they used to sell at church fairs and things like that.
It is exactly that style. You got it.
The Tri-County Tourism Alliance is one of the sponsors or supporters of this particular project, and that seems to be a real good effort in that part of South Central North Dakota where the Germans from Russia are concentrated in the state. They're building. You're building interest in that part of the state?
Yeah, they see it. They're trying to create a tourism to go along with this. They're publicizing the restaurants that are in the area, the cultural events, I think some of the cemeteries and churches as well. They are publicizing the events that take place there. You know, there are Oktoberfests in the fall that are coming up. A lot of church fairs come up in the fall as well. And we were able to go to some of them. The Strasburg Church Fair, we actually feature inside the documentary as well, taking a visit to that. But that's just one of the many church fairs that take place. And then you mentioned the sausage makers, whether you're at Zeeland or Napoleon or Wishick or Ashley. There are sausage makers, and people, when they go there, when we went down there, at least three different people said, you have to bring me authentic sausage. And each of them named a different one of those towns where they think the best is from. And then on top of that, the Kuchen, whether it be the commercial Kuchen that we can get here, like from Grandma's Kuchen, which is made in Ashley, or going to the Linton, the Model Bakery in Linton, which is more of the hometown type of Kuchen. And then, of course, you make it at home if there's a wedding in the family as well. So you get quite a variety there.
Well, I grew up in Minnesota before I moved to North Dakota, where there were a lot of Germans from Germany. And it used to be easier to find a German restaurant. It's actually rather difficult these days. So is this a tradition that's in danger of going away?
Well, I'm not the expert on that. I think that the food will continue. The language, unfortunately, for many people is on the wane. But I think the food traditions actually – and we've been doing this for a number of years now. Since the mid-90s, we've been tracking a lot of this. I'm finding – as and one of the things that Michael Miller really emphasized when we were starting to think about this was showing – young people learning those traditions. So you just heard the Napoleon School. We have a number of 4-H groups that were involved with making the food, and then a family making cheese buttons together. So I think you do see the recipes. You do see the food being handed down. And this is the food the kids want. I mean, of course, they want fast food if they're in their McDonald's or something. But this is the food they expect to get at home. So Yeah, the sons and daughters are learning at mom's and grandma's foot in the kitchen, just like their ancestors would have, the different types of food. And then they, of course, Americanize it a little bit.
Oh, yeah, we have brats, we have pot roast and gravy, those kinds of things. But you mentioned kuchen, you mentioned, you haven't mentioned Nefla soup, but you mentioned sausage. These are recipes that actually have, they're easy to find across North
Dakota. Oh, yeah, and I think you mentioned Nefla soup. I'm finding Nefla soup more and more common in restaurants. We were doing this Vietnam project, and we went across the state gathering interviews with Vietnam vets. So we stopped in a lot of restaurants around North Dakota. And it's not just in the German-Russian triangle. You see it on menus throughout the state. And, you know, little different varieties, a little variation, but it's Nefla soup. And I think that's going to stay with North Dakota. Just like the soup stays with you, it's going to stay with North Dakota for a long time.
Well, there's that Kroll's Diner that sells Nefla soup, yep, among other things, and yep, their motto is sit down and eat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So are there pieces of this that can maybe benefit from some entrepreneurism here? I mean, the sausage, for example, or the kuchen, for example.
Yeah, if you and we talk about that a little bit, especially when you look at grandma's kuchen, which is distributed quite a difference. The sausage, there's a number of the sausage that you can get mail order. So you can mail order, you know, get your recipes, get your order in and get it mailed to you. I think the one in Napoleon, the Schmidt's locker in Napoleon.
Oh, sure.
I know that you can order stuff there. You find out a lot of little interesting things in that because of the modern health standards, they really, the way that all of the food is processed now for distribution goes through a very rigorous standards. They don't get the meat from the farmer. I mean, they get USDA inspected meat coming in. So it's more the blends that they put together that you're getting. Where years ago they would have had a farmer come in and do the butchering. Now they can butcher for the farmer, but they can't sell that. They can give the stuff back to the farmer, but they can't sell that. So they have to use inspected meat. So, you know, They wear gloves when they make this stuff, Doug.
Heaven's sakes, what's the world coming to?
Yeah.
Well, the history part of this is a very rich history, and you mentioned Michael Miller with the Germans from Russia Institute at NDSU. That is a treasure trove of information right
Yeah,
there.
The heritage collection there is world-class, to say the least, and Michael has really made it the go-to spot when people are doing any type of research on the Germans from Russia.
So it premieres Thursday, September 7th at 7 p.m. Central Time.
Mm-hmm.
And can people get a copy of it if they want?
Yes, they can by becoming a member. We have the membership levels. You can get a copy of the DVD and you can get a copy of the cookbook. And we are sort of embargoing that for a while before they will go on sale. So if you want to get them, it's through a membership.
Well, we just ripped the lid off that secret.
All right.
Okay. Bob Dambach, the director of television for Prairie Public, and the show is Gutes Essen, Good Eating in German-Russian Country. Coming up next on Main Street, a report on grocery stores in small towns from Harvest Public Media.
Hello, I'm Errol Bepcorn. You might think that because I'm the voice of Dakota Datebook that I love history. Well, I do. But I also love the blues. I love playing the blues on my harmonica. And I love hearing the blues on Mike Olson's Saturday Evening Blues Cruise here on Prairie Public. There's nothing like dragging Broadway on a nice Saturday night and cranking up the blues loud on the radio. A blues show that can give you a lift. The Saturday Evening Blues Cruise, 9 p.m., 8 Mountain Time on Prairie Public.
Oh, yeah.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Shrinking rural towns mean shrinking markets for many businesses, including critical community assets like grocery stores. In Kansas, for example, more than 40 small-town grocery stores have closed over the last 9 years. Harvest Public Media's Brian Thompson reports on a plan to counter that trend.
A blonde brick building that was the only grocery store in St. John, Kansas, now sits vacant, its glass doors covered with craft paper, since Kroger shut it down early last year. Now the closest grocery store is 12 miles away. Amy Collins says that means meals require advanced planning.
Now when we make a trip to the grocery store, we are planning 4, 5, 6 days out in advance. So you have to be much more efficient, a little smarter in your planning and in your grocery shopping.
Stafford County wants to bring a grocery store back to St. John. Carolyn Dunn, who heads the local economic development agency, is leading the effort. She says two feasibility studies have shown the town could support a larger store, one big enough to offer the kind of variety that might keep shoppers from traveling to Great Bend or Pratt.
I eat kale now, and I didn't as a kid, you know. So we need a store that offers some kind of approximation to what they can get in bigger areas, we believe, in order for it to have long-term success. It requires a new store.
Stafford County has a tentative deal with White's Foodliner to operate a store that would be 3 times the size of the one that closed. The new store would offer fuel and a pharmacy, something St. John has lacked for a generation. But they have to come up with $3 million to build it. Foodliner would pay some rent, and the town has agreed to kick in sales and property taxes. But Dunn is still waiting on an $800,000 grant from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services.
The combination of the tax increment finance and the rent and so forth, if we're able to get the grants in the first place that we hope to, we'll be able to make the bills and make it break even.
Without the federal grant, Dunn says the whole project is likely to collapse. U.S. Senator Jerry Moran has another idea for getting grocers to build or expand in food deserts like St. John. He's co-sponsoring a bill that would offer federal tax credits.
If this incentive is in place, it creates a greater opportunity for local folks to encourage, support, recruit, and then be customers of a grocery store.
Not only do full-service grocery stores help people eat better and stay healthier, Moran says for small towns, few things are more important for economic health.
Often the most important feature of whether or not a community's got a future is whether or not there's a grocery store.
One town over from St. John, in Stafford, the mom-and-pop grocery store has been chugging along for 32 years without government financing or grants. Jim Chancellor and his wife purchased Paul's Grocery from his parents 4 years ago. With fridges humming behind him, Chancellor says a store like his can't undersell major retailers like Walmart and Dillon's, but they can't match his customer service.
People bring a ham in, knowing they didn't get it here, to ask it, you know, if we'd slice it for them. Well, sure, and we don't charge them for it.
Chancellor put in a new sidewalk and parking in front of his store 2 years ago. Last year, he replaced his upright freezers and meat cooler with new energy-efficient models. Moran's legislation would provide tax credits for upgrades like that. Chancellor says that would be nice, but not game-changing. But he's really not thrilled that St. John is subsidizing a new store. Competition with tax money.
If you want to open up a business, bite the bullet and do it.
Pat White, who runs White's Foodliner, doesn't see Chancellor's store as competition, though. In deciding where to put a store, he's more concerned with finding a town that has at least 2,000 people, preferably a county seat, and that is at least 30 miles from the nearest big box supermarket.
If you're 15 miles away, it just becomes too easy for your customers to make numerous trips. You know, if you're 30 to 60 miles away, you've got a chance of keeping them home.
With the public financing, White doesn't have to cover the cost of the building. That makes operating a store in St. John, which is a little too small and a little too close to Walmart and Dillon's, less of a gamble. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Brian Thompson.
Brian Thompson's reporting is part of the Kansas News Service, a collaboration covering health, education, and politics in Kansas. Dakota Datebook is next.
There are pub crawls. Those are fun. Even zombie crawls. Those are a little scary. And here's one that's fun and educational.
I'll show you how to put some of nature's masterpieces right here on the canvas.
Studio Crawls. It's one of the best events in the Red River Valley area, and it's free. The FM Visual Artists Studio. Studio Crawl, October 7th and 8th, noon to 6 p.m.
It's going to spark a lot.
You can tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists.
Lately, I've been painting with a lot of metallic paints.
You know, you go to a museum to look at the art.
The juxtaposition of color is amazing.
Well, you can go on the Studio Crawl to look at the artists. Go ahead, they won't bite. See painters, potters, sculptors, a glassblower, all demonstrating their work and talking with you about their lives as working artists.
Just work all the time.
Yes, you can be a working artist, not just a starving artist. Get your studio crawl map at prairiepublic.org/events. The FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl, October 7th and 8th, noon to 6.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 6th. The 2001-2002 season was a rough one for the University of North Dakota hockey team. It was the first time since 1994 that they played a losing season, and the first time in 5 years that they did not make the Western Collegiate Hockey Association's Final Five tournament. Many factors played into this, such as the large number of rookies. However, there was also the rough patch for two of the players, brothers Ryan and David Hale. Ryan and David were from Colorado Springs. They were good hockey players. When Ryan first arrived for the 99-2000 season, he was on the team that won North Dakota's seventh NCAA national championship. Brother David joined the team the following season, but only played 8 games with his brother before Ryan suffered a shoulder injury and had to sit out the rest of the schedule, watching from the sidelines as David and the rest of the team lost in overtime to Boston in the championship. Then, a month later, David's luck took an unfortunate turn when he developed a kidney condition that affected his play. But the biggest struggle for the brothers was the loss of their mother. Jennifer Enoch died on this date in 2001 after an 8-year struggle with breast cancer. Encouraging words she wrote a year before addressed the family's challenges. She wrote, "Turn adversity into adventure, criticism into compassion, trouble into tenacity, problems into positives, opposition into opportunity, slump into success, sorrow into support, and mistakes into miracles." After their season of hardships, the boys took on leadership roles as the team rebounded with a winning record of 26-12. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
In Muncie, Indiana, the job market is good, but employers are still having problems filling positions. One reason? Too many applicants are failing drug tests, and it's hurting businesses.
We have companies, overseas companies, that are coming to us for us to be a supplier to them, and their number one question is workforce and sober workforce.
How the opioid epidemic is affecting the economy on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, the annual Theodore Roosevelt Symposium will include Char Miller, who will talk about Roosevelt, and the first chief of the U.S. Forest Service, Gifford Pinchot. We'll hear from Miller and symposium moderator Clay Jenkinson on Main Street on Thursday. Chef Tim Rosendahl of Rosie's Bistro will join us to talk about chicken, and Ashley Thornburg and I will have our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.